Hello and welcome to the Professional Learning for Teachers channel on Radio EduTalk. My name is David Noble, I'm in Dalgety Bay in Scotland, and I'm delighted to welcome to the show today Mike Brown, who is a chartered teacher in Dumfries and Galloway. Good evening, Mike.
Good evening, David. Good evening.
Fantastic to have you along. Just to start off with, could you give listeners a kind of brief background to your career in education?
I trained as a primary school teacher back in the late 1980s. I worked for a few years in County Durham before going abroad. I spent most of the 1990s and the early 2000s working abroad in places as diverse as Saudi Arabia and Kuwait, also the Philippines and New Zealand. I came home in 2003. I'd started working in special education in Lancashire back in the mid 90s. I had a couple of years back home in the 90s, and it was something I always wanted to do. Although I trained as a primary teacher, I did want to go into special education / learning support, and that's what I did in the mid 90s. I came home having been a learning support teacher and a special SENCO in schools overseas. I came home in 2003 and I started working for... I'm from Cumbria originally, and I wanted to return to Cumbria, and I was offered a post in Dumfries and Galloway in 2004, and I've been here ever since.
Okay, that's great.
As a learning support teacher, I might add, as an additional support for learning teacher in primary schools.
Now, as ever with the shows on this particular channel on Radio EduTalk, whether you're listening to the live show or the podcast, if you just go to edutalk.cc, you've also got the option of clicking on what we call a key link, and that opens up some text that you've recommended for listeners to do with the topics that we'll be discussing later on in tonight's show, and also... You've been very kind to offer up a couple of reflective questions for listeners. Now, I'll just go through them just now. Your first question is, to what extent is education policy and practice in Scotland founded upon research? And secondly, through professional update, will teachers become more autonomous and proactive in identifying their own professional development needs? And again, no doubt through the next half hour or so we'll be touching on these particular questions. You've also kindly provided us, Mike, with some very interesting links. You have put a link up to some of your reflections on teacher professionalism, and you've also written for the Researching Education Bulletin, which I think is produced by CIRA, if I remember correctly, and that's a condensed version of your dissertation, and you also have put up a link to a paper that you wrote following a professional development visit to Australia, and really these are the two main things that we'll be talking about this evening. If you're listening to the live show, you can get in touch with comments or questions for Mike in two ways. You can email edutalker@hotmail.co.uk, that's edutalkr, or if you're on Twitter, you can pop something up there and just include the hashtag edutalk. So Mike, the particular research into personalisation and choice, can you just give us an idea about what the stimulus was? Where did that kind of originate from as an area of research interest for you? And can you take us through the kind of early stages of your research journey?
Okay, sure. Well, I began my chartered teacher course in 2007. The 2 years prior to that, I'd done a postgraduate certificate in additional support for learning through Dumfries and Galloway and the University of Strathclyde. Prior to coming to work in Dumfries and Galloway, I'd done a few modules of an MA in special education leads through Middlesex University. So at the end of the postgraduate certificate in additional support for learning, there was a meeting with representatives from the University of Strathclyde who put forward the idea of doing the chartered teacher course, and I felt that was a really good idea. I really wanted to do it. Thought it was a really good way of developing my own knowledge and expertise without having to go into a promoted post, which I wasn't particularly interested in doing. I wanted to but I felt as though the knowledge and the skills that I gained from the PGC ASL would lend themselves to doing the chartered teacher course. So I did a few APL claims edition, accreditation prior learning claims, and also modules on able pupils and teacher professionalism. For my final research project, I wanted to. I felt as an additional support for a learning teacher, I felt as though in some way I wasn't really engaged as much as I could have been in a curriculum for excellence and the building the curriculum agenda. So, discussing with my tutor, we looked at ways of becoming involved, not necessarily entirely with pupils with additional support needs, but also mainstream pupils as well. So, through conversations with my tutor, I took on the idea of looking into one particular aspect of building the curriculum, which was personalization and choice, and I felt as though that would really fit in with what I did with additional support for learning, and also would develop my skills and knowledge and expertise of working within a curriculum for excellence. So that's where that came from, really.
And at the time that you were carrying out your research, am I right in saying that there was a cross-curricular project going around within the school at the time that kind of linked into to your actual research project?
Absolutely, yeah. That was the school that I chose to do my research in was doing the primary 6 and 7 class was doing something called a GNOME challenge, and I'm going to just look at what GNOME means and just refresh my memory. It was garden. Let me just check. Garden for Nature Outdoor Makeover Enterprise, which sounds like a very very grand title. But the basics of it was that groups of pupils within the class would be given the challenge of doing a makeover of a part of the school grounds. They were given a nominal budget of £1,000, and they had to come up with their own ideas as to how they would develop the ground. So it was very much a cross-curricular topic in which pupils could define their own roles within groups and bring their own knowledge and expertise and interests to their particular group. At the end of the project, each group pitched their idea to the whole school, and the most popular pitch would be able to take their project forward and redevelop that particular area of the school grounds. A lot of it was based on things like The Dragon's Den and The Apprentice, the television programs, which obviously the children were familiar with. And I think I have to say there that I choose the school deliberately for doing that final project. It's a very good school, very very well run, with teachers who are open to new ideas. One of the phrases that struck me in doing my background reading was the school was convivial, not coercive, and I knew that I would get a really good chance to get some useful information from the pupils and to work very closely with the staff in order to get all the information that I needed.
And just before we kind of hear more about the kind of research questions and how you went about gathering data, Mike, we're talking about personalisation and choice here, and I think you allude to it in your articles based on your final project that it's not black and white when it comes to defining these terms, and that's so often the case within kind of educational theory and terminology. So can you just touch on what we might mean by personalisation and choice, and also the kind of problems around the use of these terms?
Yeah. One of the things that really stood out for me in doing my research is that there was no clear agreement on what personalisation and choice actually meant. So I think the phrase conceptual elasticity really stood out, and it was really hard to pin it down. And I think even people who were behind the whole idea of personalization and choice as a policy development, acknowledged that it was a policy ahead of the evidence. And I think that was, from that point of view, it was quite difficult to define it. But obviously, there are lots of. I think the whole thing came about around just over 10 years ago, in England particularly, where it was seen as an extension of the consumer world that we live in, and you know, pupils will be given more choices in their learning. And I think the critics kind of pounced on that and said that. Do we really want to be bringing the market into education? Whereas advocates of it gave it a more kind of concrete justification by saying that pupils were going to be creators of their learning, or constructors of their learning, or investors in their learning, and to make it a more enduring kind of thing. But it was sort of difficult to pin down from that point of view, that because there's no clear agreement as to what it actually is. I think we can make of it what we will. I think we can. It can be whatever we make of it. And if we found our own ways of giving pupils choice in what they do, then we can be said to be personalising their learning.
And again, going back to some of the writers and documents that you reference in your own work, Mike, you know, it seems to, you say yourself, it ties in with notions of child-centeredness, maybe back to the 60s, and I know, working in a care setting myself, that's very much to the fore with the so-called GERFIC agenda, etc., and tied in with kind of new notions of pedagogy or learning, and in terms of the co-constructivist approach to learning. But how does that sit with you when, you know, like myself, you work in a school where there are hidden power relations, let alone very explicit power relations in terms of between the adult and the child. So did you come into this project kind of dubious about the possibility of a personalisation of choice agenda working, or is it something that you were kind of intrinsically passionate about trying to help introduce into your school, or indeed across the system?
I think, if I'm honest, I came into it with an open mind. It was something that I just wanted to explore and to find out what it was going to mean. And I think we're very much in an era now where pupils are having much more of a say in their own learning, and they have different ways of demonstrating their learning. We're moving rapidly away from the idea that pupils produce an essay at the end of a project. They can demonstrate their learning in lots of different ways through a presentation or a performance or a piece of artwork or whatever. And I think that's particularly important for pupils with additional support needs, that they can be, they can prove that they have learned in lots of different ways. And I think that's sort of fostering a genuine dialogue between teachers and schools and pupils in a way that pupils are being encouraged to think about what they're going to learn and how they're going to learn it. And I think that's a positive change, and I think the best schools, certainly a lot of the schools that I work in, are seeing that as a positive development, and they're very much aware of this journey that we're on. The education isn't a one size fits all situation. It's something that, as I say, pupils can demonstrate their learning in lots of different ways.
And going back to your research, can you say then about what particular questions or what your quest was in around personalisation choice through your research, and talk a bit about your methods for gathering data?
Yeah, I think it's important to say here that again something that really stood out for me was that pupils aged between sort of 5 and 6 up to around 11 and 12 primary age pupils are somewhat unrepresented in educational research. Most research that has taken place has involved preschool children, or it's involved secondary age children. So I think I was kind of hoping that I was adding to the body of research into primary school pupils, as they are somewhat unrepresented. There was lots of useful information out there for gathering research, and I think if anybody was considering going on and doing a master's degree, that's one of the bits of advice I would give them, that there are lots and lots of really, really useful books and resources out there for gathering data. For example, there is one, I'm just checking on the actual title here, by Bond, Your Master's Thesis, How to Plan, Draft, Write, and Revise. And I think that that pretty much does what it says on the tin. And I got lots of useful information from that particular book about coding pupils' answers. There was a lot of qualitative data generated in terms of conversations and focus groups and things like that. So it's really important to find ways of coding all the information that was produced by through the discussions that I had with the pupils. And coding can be done in a very simple way: a positive comment or a negative comment, or it can be categorized in a lot more detail. So that was a very useful source of advice there, and also triangulation, being able to find out different points of view from different sources as well. That was something that came out from the reading that I did. So there was, I think any research project as part of a master's degree is going to generate a lot of data. But I think there is a lot. What has to be said is that there is a lot of useful advice, some useful tips out there for how to deal with that data.
And so, what were your findings then? The ones that made it into your final dissertation?
Yeah. Well, I think pupils were very much interested in the idea. I mean, they were wonderfully eloquent and reflective and articulate and they were not in any way. Most of the pupils that I spoke to were really. Really forthcoming. They were really interested in the whole idea of being given more choice, motivating them, and I think a lot of them recognised the importance and the significance of that. I put it to them right at the very start of the project that this was a two-way process that I was going to learn from them as part in as much as I'm learning from the project they were doing. So they were really really interested in that as an idea. A lot of what they said would support the idea that the personalization and choice is more motivational. I think there was a lot of evidence to point to that. One or two expressed reservations. Perhaps we'll come to that in a minute. But yeah, lots and lots of positives came out of the discussions that I had with the pupils. But I do keep going back to my main sort of premise, I think, that my main conclusion is that there hasn't been a lot of research into this idea of personalization and choice, and there isn't enough, there's insufficient evidence of it as being an effective educational method at the moment.
I mean, I found it interesting again. Look at a little bit about your methods, although it was based on my reading of the article in the Researching Education Bulletin. And obviously, as a piece of action research, you're talking to the young people about personalisation and choice in the context of the cross curricular project. When the pupils are kind of self-reporting that they felt as if they had choice and they felt that it existed and possibly they had a great deal of choice, you know, for you as a researcher, is Was that sufficient then? Was that of sufficient interest and relevance to be reported, or was there any kind of reluctance on your part, or need to triangulate? You talked about that earlier, and also getting some evidence from elsewhere that actually this was a good thing and was having positive impacts on the young person's well-being or happiness or indeed educational outcomes. Or
Sure.
is that something that would be, for a future research project?
Well, I think this is a very small, well, smallish piece of research in one small school in Dumfries and Galloway, and I think that we, I just wanted the research project as a whole to make some sort of contribution to the whole debate about curriculum for excellence and the strands within it of which personalization choice is one. There was evidence there. I think the majority of the discussions that I had with the pupils, they spoke positively of the idea. They may not have sort of realized it implicitly that they were being given this choice. I mean, for example, they were organized into groups, and they had to define their roles within the group. And I think that was something that was organic and evolved, and they became aware of it as time went on. I mean, to give you a sort of example of it, one of the pupils who was a dyslexic pupil who didn't really involve herself all that much within what the group was doing. She was kind of taking a little bit of a step back, and I spoke to her. I said, "So what are you doing? What's your job at the moment? What's your role?" And I thought it was really interesting, actually, because one group was working in one part of the school, one part of her group was working in one part of the school, and another part was working in another. And she said, "Well, I'm the messenger. I'm taking the messages backwards and forwards between the two groups." And I thought that was really interesting. It was almost like she wasn't doing the sort of the real cutting edge research as to what was going to this particular part of the garden, but she defined a role for herself in terms of taking the messages between the two groups. So I just thought, well, that was a really interesting kind of vignette as to how this thing was working. The groups were pretty much left to run. The groups were autonomous, and they were allowed to find out to define their own roles, and this particular child had done so. I think, on the other hand, there were some reservations from some pupils as regards personalization and choice. Again, they were very, very articulate, very forthcoming with their ideas, and some felt as though there was a lack of structure in their learning. Some were concerned about the composition of the groups and about choice being a distraction to their overall learning. So again, they were very articulate about it. As I said earlier, I just want to just contribute to the evidence, because there is a lack of an evidence base for personalization in choice, and I just felt as though this was contributing to the body of evidence surrounding this particular subject.
And just before we go in, maybe to find out a bit about how your research has influenced your practice long term, may come. I'm just wondering about a couple of other things that I picked up just from following some of the links to some texts in your bibliography. First of all, you referenced Maclean's three A's around motivation, pupil motivation. Can you just give listeners a kind of brief idea about what that's all about?
Sure. Yes, I read the work of Alan Maclean quite extensively in my research. And I think one of his very telling quotes is, "Motivation is the new discipline." And I thought that was a really, really nice comment there. The three A's that he talks about: learners being empowered by having choices and responsibilities and opportunities for decision making. And he talks particularly about the three A's, first of which is affiliation, where pupils identify not only with the school, with their school, but also with the group in which they're working. He talks about agency, the importance of task value, and pupils buying into the task that they're doing and knowing what's in it for them. And the final one was the final of the three A's was autonomy, and I think getting pupils to work on their own and to work independently, work autonomously is something that is something that we all strive to do as teachers. And I think that MacLean described that as the gold dust of the of that idea. So affiliation, agency, and autonomy were the three A's that MacLean referred to.
And going back to when you were kind of looking at how there may be some problems around the way that we might be conceptualising personalisation and choice. Am I right in saying that, I don't know if it was maybe yourself, Mike, or whether it's other writers, is there a suggestion that this kind of language is now replacing the language, for example, of differentiation? Are they synonymous, or are we talking about two very distinct things, which both still exist within education?
I think advocates of personalisation and choice see it as a natural evolution from differentiation, and see that we've moved from differentiation into personalisation and choice. So that, I think that was. That's one of the ideas behind it. But as I say, I think I mentioned it earlier on that a lot of the terminology that's used that critics are critical of is this idea that it is part of the consumerist culture in which we live, and the use of the market, and that pupils can go out and almost. Do supermarket shopping for what they want to learn, but the other side of it was that more sort of solid and enduring language, like investing and constructing and creating that advocates used.
So how has this piece of research influenced your practice?
Well, I think it really does make me. It served a purpose in one way, in that it made me really it got me to think more about curriculum for excellence and how I use experiences and outcomes to inform my day to day work, which the majority of which is with pupils with additional support needs. So getting me to really think about experiences and outcomes, and I think that was one thing that I possibly learned from doing the dissertation to really embed that in my day-to-day practice. So when I'm doing things like individual education plans, I will use experiences and outcomes, or I'll use the terminology of the of curriculum for excellence in when I'm target setting. So that's part of my day-to-day work. I also again, really, several times a year, each pupil with whom I work, I will sit down with them and I'll talk to them about what they've enjoyed doing, what they feel as though they need to be doing, what anything that they're anxious about or they feel as though they're struggling with, and just try to have a genuine dialogue between myself and the pupil. And it can be, even with the youngest of pupils, I think we can get some really interesting views and information from them as to how they feel as though things are progressing, and to try and the things that they're more confident about, and they feel as though they do best, to try and sort of tailor things so that they're able to have as many positive experiences as possible, and the things that they are struggling with, to try and figure out what we can do in order to between us as part of the dialogue, to try and figure out what it is we can do to support them as best we can, and what they like doing, what they dislike doing, and as I say, just to try and make it so that they feel as though they're empowered, they have a say in the process, they have a stake in the enterprise. And I think that's something that I took from the It was probably something I was doing before, but it really sort of brought home to me that that's it was really important to give people that voice and that say in what they do.
It's so clear from listening to you, Mike, and from reading your recent work, you know, as a chartered teacher, how committed you are to your own professional learning. And although we're maybe coming into the last 10 minutes or so of the show, could you take us through your recent study trip to Australia, where the idea came from, how on earth you managed to actually bring it all together, and then it'd be fascinating, again, as somebody who is working with an ASN, to hear about some of your own, from your experience of the studies trip, kind of comparisons that you noted between the UK or Scotland and Australia in terms of ASN provision.
Sure. It's a bit of a long story. Bear with me. My partner Angie is an artist and also an academic working in the field of textiles. She was invited to go to the University of Canberra for a 3-month residency back in the latter part of 2012, and she was set to do a major project and an exhibition of her work in December 2012. So obviously I was really keen to go over there and support her to do that. So I came up with the idea of doing a project whereby I could be in Australia and also do some really interesting work with people in Australian Capital Territory who were doing a similar job to myself. So it was really just sort of seeing an opportunity and going for it, really. I was able to sort of get a number of my colleagues on board, and they were very supportive of my ideas in terms of the possible outcomes to the research that I could do. So so it was really just, it was a bit, I suppose it was a little bit opportunistic, but I did feel as though it was something that could be done and something that very worthwhile could come out of it, and hopefully it did. I made contacts with, as I say, people who were doing a similar sort of peripatetic learning support job in Canberra. I managed to meet them, and they were very generous and very, very accommodating and very giving of their time in terms of setting up a lot of meetings, a lot of visits, and things like that. So it was a really interesting few days. Sadly, it was cut short by a close family bereavement, and we had to return home at very short notice. But I did manage to get a few days really interesting work out of my visit, and to be able to make a few comparisons between what the practice in Canberra and what we do in Dumfries and Galloway in Scotland as a whole.
So what struck you most?
I think there are lots of similarities and also some significant differences in how we. In how we go about in our provision for pupils with learning support needs. I think one of the main differences, one of the most significant differences that I found was that in Canberra, in Australian Capital Territory as a whole, there's a lot more early intervention. There's work with pupils as young as 18 months old. They're identified as having communication difficulties and social issues and things like that. So there are a lot of different parents and toddler play groups and things like that, which are designed specifically for benefiting pupils who are seen as being at risk of having difficulties when they get to primary school. And the idea behind that is that their needs are met and addressed and worked on so that there's less possibility of them requiring some sort of learning support when they get to primary school, and I think that was the main difference that I saw, and I think that kind of it's followed me back to Dumfries and Galloway. I think we're being as additional support for learning teachers. I think more so over the coming years, we're going to be encouraged to work with younger children and to work with the professionals who work with them when children are at risk of having some sort of difficulty, whatever that difficulty may be. They use there's a lot of capacity building for mainstream teachers in terms of the use of online training. There's a company based in, I think it's in Brighton, and they do a lot of, they have an extensive online training resource which mainstream teachers were expected to follow in terms of working on dyslexia and things like autism spectrum disorders. And it was just really building mainstream teachers' capacity for their understanding of those particular children's needs. So that was a really interesting resource that they were using. The peripatetic teams had an ICT specialist, and they were able to identify pupils who may benefit from specific or specialised ICT resources. That's something that we don't have, and I thought that was a really useful thing that they use there. And they have different ways of assessing which children may benefit from such resources, use of matrices and rubrics and things like that. And I think that was a bit of a difference. But I think the use of matrices is something that again have kind of followed me. Followed me back here. And I was also able to identify, I think, comparing the two systems, I think it was important to say that I felt as though we had some relative strengths as well in Dumfries and Galloway. So for example, there's in Canberra, there was very little intervention with pupils with literacy difficulties and dyslexia, to the point where I think a lot of parents were campaigning to improve the provision for children with dyslexia in mainstream schools. And I think that's something that we do really well. It's a core part of our work. It's something that we do on a day-to-day basis. We also, one of the things that I was able to find was that the use of speech and language therapists and education psychologists is less straightforward than our model because of the funding arrangements that they have. It wasn't so easy to work collaboratively with those particular professionals and with individual pupils. And again, that's something that I think we do fairly well. It's something that's part of our, I wouldn't say day-to-day practice, but we are very much involved on a sort of a collaborative and collegiate basis in working with professionals from other disciplines. So it was good to be able to sort of hold ourselves up and say, well, I think we do that pretty well.
Yeah. No, it's really interesting. And we're just coming to the end. Just a couple of questions to finish up, mate. You're, in a moment we'll hear a little bit about your kind of recent thoughts on teacher professionalism in Scotland. That's kind of bound up, I suppose, with ongoing developments, hopefully to improve PRD across the system, but also with the GTCS's professional update scheme. So just before we kind of touch on that in a kind of system-wide basis, we've talked about two very ambitious and successful projects that you've been involved in, both very different, but do you have ambitious plans for the near future in terms of your professional learning and development?
Well, I have had something of a since my Australia trip. I've had a little bit of a hiatus in terms of my own professional learning, in terms of producing anything like a research paper or anything like that. I mean, partly due to the bereavement I mentioned earlier on, and the aftermath of that, and also my partner Angie moved down to London not so long ago with her work, so a lot of time has been spent going backwards and forwards between Cumbria and London and trying to spend as much time together as possible. But no, I definitely have some ideas going. I've been doing a maths recovery course, a large group of learning support teachers in Dumfries and Galloway have been doing a programme organised by the Maths Recovery Trust, I believe it is, and a few of us are going forward to be accredited, fully accredited Maths Recovery tutors. So that's going to be something after the Easter holiday. I have been doing some a little bit of work with the call centre based at the University of Edinburgh. They have a Books for All project. And after the Easter holiday, we're going to be looking at getting pupils with literacy difficulties, how to make sure that they can engage with books and literature. And I'm really interested in the whole idea of dyslexia and how it is that some pupils who have so many strengths in other areas do find it difficult to read and write and spell and things like that. And I did quite an extensive accreditation of prior learning project for my as part of my chartered teacher studies course. And I think it's about time that I refreshed my knowledge on dyslexia. So I plan to do a sort of a literature review before too long, just to kind of refresh my own knowledge there. It's something that I'm absolutely fascinated in, and the effect of the brain and the different brain functions and how that affects reading and spelling and things like that. So that's something that I hope to get off the ground before too long.
Now, as I said at the top of the show, for listeners, if you just visit the edutalk.cc website, you'll be able to access just underneath the audio player some of the important links and some of the papers that Mike's mentioned tonight. The first paper, which I think I'll be right in saying would be the most recent one, is kind of... It's where you're talking around teacher professionalism, which we haven't really talked about, but obviously doing your chartered teacher studies, like most if not all chartered teacher candidates in years gone by, all examining teacher professionalism right back to the times when it was regarded more as a vocation, and it's interesting how that kind of plays out nowadays as well. But this article that you've written recently, you kind of talk about teacher professionalism and kind of bound in with pain conditions, and you seem to be suggesting that there should be quite a step change with regards to, I don't know, maybe incentivising action research and system transformation.
Sure.
Can you just take us through the kind of main points of that paper?
Oh, just to clarify, that paper that I sent to you yesterday and which you very kindly put on the website is. Dates back to, I think, 2007 and the very start of my chartered teacher journey, so to speak. And that piece I wrote was part of my first chartered teacher assignment. But it's something that I felt I got really interested in at the time, and it's stayed with me all the way through since then. This whole idea that. The work of Michael Erhout and David Carr, that teaching is only, when compared to other graduate professions like medicine and law, that we can only regard teaching as a semi-profession or a vocation. And the whole idea behind that was that there is a lack of, that very persuasive argument was that teaching doesn't have the same status as medicine and law because of the lack of a theoretical underpinning for our day-to-day work, and I think there is so much evidence there to suggest that there isn't enough, there is insufficient evidence for what we do on a day-to-day basis, and I think the teachers are a real sort of untapped resource in terms of providing giving us more evidence to inform policy and things like that. And I think the Donaldson report mentioned it a few years ago that professional learning is an integral part of educational change. I think I'm quoting directly there. There was a very interesting report from the Royal Society of Edinburgh just a couple of years ago into a curriculum for excellence, and it's an actually quite a damning. Some of the phrases that they use are very. It's very strongly worded. It says the evidence base for the effectiveness for a curriculum for excellence is nowhere to be found. And I think we need to see this as a two-way process. I think teachers need to be more involved. I would personally love to see teachers more involved in research. And I think that the other side of that coin is that policymakers need more evidence that teachers can provide for policies to be truly effective. And I would encourage anybody who has any interest in this to read the Royal Society of Edinburgh report from, I think it's from May 2012. It's a really interesting commentary on the whole basis for curriculum for excellence. And I really do think that professional update is a positive step. I really hope that teachers are able to embrace the idea of having more say in their learning. I think a lot of evidence is out there that points to professional development not really being not really meeting teachers' needs, and that teachers are just simply passive recipients of professional development. And I think if we can really empower our colleagues to say, well, you know, you're really going to benefit from this, and you can really have a positive impact on the policies that affect your day-to-day work, then I think it's something that we need to grasp. I think it's going to be a long process because obviously it's going to be done on a five-year basis that people are involved in refresh their standards and so forth. But I think I hope it's a positive change and a positive development, and I do hope that teachers are given the autonomy to identify their own learning needs and to work with each other on research projects and to really to really embrace this particular idea and to really contribute to policy making as a whole within Scotland. I think it's something that could be really beneficial.
Mike, it's been fantastic having you on the show.